I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Does America have a transportation strategy? We'll speak with David Goldberg of Transportation for America to find out what realtors, civic leaders, urban planners, and nonprofit organizations are doing to tackle the problem of how we get around. And we'll speak with John Campbell about one of the most exciting revitalization projects happening in North America, the Toronto Waterfront. Waterfront Toronto, which John leads, is working to reclaim land along the shore to create parks, public spaces, and cultural institutions with attendant mixed-use development to create a contemporary, sustainable wonder. All that plus our regular contributors, Walker Smith, and the news from Nate Berg of Plan Edison. Coming up on today's Smart City, right after this news. I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. U.S. transportation policy has barely changed since the 1950s, with President Eisenhower's launch of the National Highway System. Our guest, David Goldberg, is looking to change that. He represents Transportation for America, which is a broad coalition of urban planners, realtors, housing and environmental organizations, and business leaders who believe that the time is now for a bold new direction in transportation policy. David, does the U.S. have a transportation strategy today?
You know, I don't think we do have a transportation strategy at this point. We had one in the 1950s when Eisenhower passed the Interstate Highway Act, and we've been pretty much operating under that since then. There was a moment in the 60s when we woke up and thought, well, we need to do something about public transportation and started investing a little bit in some rail projects and resurrecting a public transportation system that had really almost died out. But we haven't had much of a strategy, and we saw this tragic situation a few years ago when the last transportation program passed, $286 billion worth of taxpayer money that was assigned to a program that had literally no statement of purpose to it anymore. The Congress had stripped it out in the legislation. So we had this collection of earmarks, the 6,000 earmarks that have now become famously identified with the Bridge to Nowhere, and that's where we are. And we've reached a point where we can't operate successfully as a nation anymore without a new transportation strategy.
Transportation, of course, has become a focus of the economic stimulus package and the conversation around how will we spend that money. What are you seeing today on economic stimulus as it relates to transportation?
Well, there was a lot of discussion early on in the context of a stimulus about the need to invest in infrastructure and to catch up with the backlog of maintenance that we have to deal with, putting people to work, building the kind of infrastructure that we need. As that discussion heated up, it became clear that the only way to distribute a lot of money now to infrastructure projects was to do it under the old system. And when we started seeing the lists of infrastructure projects, the transportation projects that the state DOTs were starting to put together, it was a lot of old think. It was big highway projects that had been in the pipeline for a long time that maybe don't make sense anymore now that we're not expecting a long-term situation of cheap energy. We've seen a drop in the amount of people driving and in the amount of money collected for the gas tax and a reconcentration of population. People are not as interested as we age and as we have fewer kids in the house and more single-person households, not as interested anymore in living way out and making long commutes. We're seeing that reflected in this housing crisis right now where the houses on the fringe are having an incredible time retaining their value, losing value at a very rapid clip. So this all comes back to how we're investing in our transportation system.
Paul Krugman, the economist who writes a regular column in the New York Times and won the Nobel Prize, makes an argument that we have to spend a lot of money and we have to spend it fast. On the other hand, like you probably, I look at this notion of spending it on new roads, new bridges, reducing congestion, and I get worried that at the end of this, we're not going to have additional money to spend on other kinds of infrastructure. So, as you say, we sort of get more of what we've got. Is there a solution to this dilemma?
There is a solution, and it's probably not going to come in the context of the stimulus. The most recent figures that we're seeing now show a more modest investment in transportation infrastructure, as low now as a piece that the Obama folks have put out as $25 billion, where we were talking maybe $100 billion over a couple of years a month ago. And I don't think it'll be quite that low, because I think when Congress gets a hold of it, it'll end up being a little bit larger. This is one thing that congresspersons can generally agree on, that their home districts love to have money to spend on infrastructure. So when we think about a stimulus, we should be thinking about the projects that can get going quickly. And mostly those will be repair and maintenance projects. There are some projects that are frankly threatened with being shut down right now because governments are losing their revenue raising capacity, their bonding capacity, and they're basically just not able to finish some projects that they've started. Those are likely to be the first priority under the new stimulus. And then you'll see projects that can get going really quickly and that don't require a lot of land acquisition and don't require a lot of planning. They're pretty much truly ready to go. And those are mostly going to be and ought to be repair and maintenance projects. We need to make sure that we have bridges that stand up and that we're not building the bridges to nowhere.
What do you expect to happen with transit in the stimulus package?
I hope that we, at a minimum, preserve what we've got. We've really seen quite a hit to transit right now, even as ridership has surged. And with gas prices even retrenching, people are still using transit at greater rates than they had been. And there's every indication points to growing demand in the future for more transit. So at a minimum, what we hope is that there is support to preserve the service that we've got and to preserve the jobs that are providing that service right now. If it's a larger package, and we're talking about a two-year time frame, then there are a lot of cities around the country, metro areas, that have plans for new rail and rapid bus systems that could be built and could be well underway within that two-year time frame. So if it's a larger figure, then we would hope that there would be a significant share, and frankly, a much larger share of the overall pie than currently happens under the existing transportation program, because that has an 80% share for highways and a 20% for everything else, which includes transit, walking, and biking. Americans are often surprised to hear that, because when we did a poll last year asking people, how would you allocate $1 or $100 of transportation money? And it's interesting, because roads are a modest share of it, 20-some percent. And a larger share would go to sidewalks, a much larger share to public transportation and to biking. So people think that we should have a much more balanced approach, but it's still very much skewed to that 1950s balance.
To what do you attribute, David, that sea change in attitudes on the part of Americans?
There are a lot of factors that are contributing. One thing that we've seen is that as metro areas have grown, we've become a very urbanized population. 80% of the population at this point lives in metropolitan areas, and that's only expected to grow. And as these metro areas have grown, it's become increasingly obvious to people that trying to pave your way into free-flowing conditions and allowing more and more people to drive by themselves absolutely everywhere they have to go for every single thing they have to do in a day is just not working. And paving more is like an overweight person loosening their belt as a weight reduction strategy. It doesn't really work. Makes you feel better for a while maybe, but then it quickly catches up to you. So that, I think, realization has sunk in for people. They've watched over time as we've attempted to keep up with the growth in traffic by widening roads and consequently destroying neighborhoods and making uglier landscapes and inducing more pollution. I think that we are a nation of smaller households, and back in the early 60s, when the interstate highway project was still in its infancy, we had about half of our households were typical nuclear family, mom, dad, and some kids. And last year, we actually flipped that demographic so that the share of single-person households is actually slightly larger than the share of those conventional nuclear family households. And so that implies something really different. We have younger people who are much more interested in an urban lifestyle, who are less interested in spending a whole lot of time in their cars. We've seen an aging population that's only going to get older as more people turn 65 each year, all the way out to the year 2025. And those are folks who are not so interested in raising crops of fescue out in the exurbs anymore and are more interested in downsizing and moving to somewhere where things are more convenient to them. And we've even seen suburban areas that grew up in the car era and never had a downtown, never had a center to them, who have been building town centers, building places that are walkable, mixed use, more dense, and where people are enjoying living and being able to be in close proximity to everything that they need. So all these factors are working together, and then we've seen the gradually rising and then the sudden surge in gas prices that brought all this home and put a really fine point on it. And although we've seen this with the economic collapse, we've seen a retrenchment of gas prices, nobody expects that to last. We've done polling, and others have done polling, asking what do you think is the future of energy prices, gas prices in this country? And everyone expects it to go up and to stay up. So all these factors have come together to reduce the love affair with the car. I've always thought that was a little bit of a misnomer. I mean, obviously, we enjoy the flexibility that we get from a vehicle to the point where we find ourselves stuck in traffic, or to the point where we find that we absolutely can't do anything without the car. And those are expensive things to keep around and to keep running. But we've built this landscape that's made it impossible for us to do anything but use the car. And now we've started to see in recent years a rethinking of that and building a lot more in a pattern that's more walkable and less car dependent.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Goldberg of Transportation for America. So now we're not focused on the stimulus to get new transportation projects. We're now focused on the transportation bill. So tell me what you expect. Tell me the timing of that bill, what's happening, and how you expect to influence it.
Well, there's a transportation bill that is so-called reauthorized by Congress every 5 or 6 years that basically lays out the policies that will set the priorities for how we spend money in this country. And as I said before, it's many billions of dollars. So this renewal of the transportation program is up again in 2009. The current program, so-called Safety Lou, expires and needs to be reauthorized. The way that it works is that most of the money that gets spent in this country on roads, bridges, on public transportation comes from this federal program, this federal allocation, and it goes through the state DOTs typically, who then decide or work with metro areas to decide exactly how the money gets spent. The current system is very much skewed towards building highways, not even so much maintaining and repairing what we have, and certainly giving short shrift to the more community level of transportation, making sure that places are safe for walking and biking and for using public transportation. So what we would like to see, this coalition that I represent, which is Transportation for America, by the way, it's a more diverse coalition working on a transportation bill than I think we've seen historically. My home organization, Smart Growth America, paired up with some other organizations, including a group called Reconnecting America, the National Association of Realtors, some of the big environmental groups, including the Natural Resources Defense Council, housing advocates, business groups. It's a really, really broad and diverse coalition who are involved in this. And what we want to see fundamentally is, first, a renewed commitment to a 21st century transportation system. We've sort of done the 1950s transportation system. We did the big highway build out. We've got that system. We need to maintain it. We need to make sure it works as efficiently as possible. Now we need to build the other half of the transportation system. Good world-class public transportation that people can reach by safely walking, biking. Not expecting, of course, cars to disappear, for us to not stop using them, but for us to be able to have a number of options. This is going to be very important for us to compete in the future as oil supplies become more constrained and there's more competition among nations for the supplies of oil. We see that China and Europe are far ahead of us on this, on the question of intercity rail, of being able to travel from city to city. As our aviation industry shudders and has increasing difficulties being economically viable, we are going to need a resilient transportation system where we have more ways to get from city to city. Again, China, Europe have those systems. So high-speed rail in the corridors where that makes sense, but then a resurgence of high-quality conventional rail in other corridors. We already see many states working on this themselves, but they need a federal partner to make this work. California, for example, just passed a high-speed rail initiative. Other states are working on both conventional and high-speed rail. So those are the kinds of things we'd like to see built. And in terms of some other policy reforms, we're a metropolitan nation. 80% of our country lives in metropolitan areas, and yet state DOTs that typically have been more about building these city-to-city highways that span rural areas are controlling how the money gets spent, and metropolitan areas are having a difficult time meeting their transportation needs, building the kind of transportation infrastructure that they need. So we think that it's about time that metro areas had a little bit more latitude in how they spend the money, and that more money was directly allocated to them. At the same time, those metro areas need to be more democratic in their representation of how they allocate the money. Some places have very good systems for that. Others have more sort of a backroom deal that needs to be daylighted.
Well, when you talk about metropolitan areas, it's the problem with the Brookings Metro Nation. There are no metropolitan governments in America. There are city governments. There are big city governments, small city governments. Together, they may make a metro area, and many of them do. As you say, 80% of us live in what the census defines as a metro area. The problem with that is there are no governments that reflect, or very, very few governments that reflect that geography. So are you talking about money going to metropolitan planning organizations? I mean, where does the money go so that it can then be distributed in ways that reflect better decisions than the states are making today?
Well, you make some very good points, and we do have this metropolitan planning system now. The metropolitan planning organizations are the ones that make the plans, the list of projects that can get funded by federal money. But that, in many cases, the DOT is the big foot on the metro planning boards, and this is the problem, one of the problems. The other issue, as you say, is that no one is, in most places, except for Portland, Oregon, and to a certain degree, the Twin Cities, Minnesota, no one has responsibility for the total health of the metropolitan area as a directly elected government. I think you can set up systems that much like the state legislatures or the U.S. Congress has representatives of certain areas that come together and make national policies or make state policies and laws. You could do the same thing on the metro level without establishing a metro government per se with a czar of the metro area. It has to have proportional representation so that larger districts have more say in how the money gets spent.
David, do you imagine calling for that change in representation in the transportation bill, in the reauthorization bill?
I think that will be a part of the reauthorization bill. I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done in coming up with the most equitable and most effective way to set these up. But it has to be done. It's been just short of a disaster how it's worked up till now, and we really can't go forward with the system that we have. So it's got to be done. And it may be done in increments. It may be that we see something, a continuation of something sort of like we have with some modest reforms as we continue to work on reforming it more. But I think it's something that really needs to be done.
Tell me a little bit more about Transportation for America. Specifically, I want to ask you why the National Association of Realtors is a part of your coalition. I think that's an interesting group and maybe an unexpected group to be involved. Tell me about how that happened.
Well, I think the realtors really care about their communities. They've been supportive of the whole idea of smart growth and better planning all along because those are the things that retain property values, that make over the long haul, make your neighborhood worth more money if it's carefully planned, if the infrastructure is good, if it's resilient. You know, it's not a disposable kind of a landscape that's built for one use and then boom, it's no good anymore. They're mostly selling homes and homes to people who consider them to be places that they want to see hold their quality over time. So if you think about it, it really makes sense for a forward-looking realtor to care about these kinds of things. And at the national level, the NAR has been very thoughtful and supportive on these issues.
What is the timing of the reauthorization bill? And particularly for people who want to express an opinion on it, how should they best do that?
The current bill expires at the end of the federal fiscal year, at the end of September this year, 2009. And the debate is likely to really start heating up this spring with the first introduction probably in the House of a draft transportation bill in April or May. But this is the time, frankly, now to start getting engaged, to find the local groups. And if you go to our website, t4america.org, you can see what groups in your state or locality may already be members. And if you know of a group that's not a member, then please by all means sign up or see if you can encourage them to sign up.
You're still open. Your coalition is still open to new members.
Oh, absolutely. And we're growing every day. We're up to 160 members right now nationally and more people signing on every week. We hope that it continues to grow. At the same time, we're developing a grassroots network. We're putting together these organizations. And what you find out is that in almost every community, there are people who are concerned about safe biking and walking, who want better public transportation system or a better integrated transportation system, who want to fix some of the bottlenecks in their roads that are not addressed every year because they're building the new stuff way out somewhere. There's a network of bloggers on these things. There's a network of local groups and state groups. And we're threading all these together to make what we hope is a powerful voice for this kind of change. And we're finding incredible enthusiasm for this as we work across the country.
If you could summarize the principles that T for America, Transportation for America, won't give on. It's like this is where we draw the line in terms of advocating for this transportation reauthorization bill. What has to be in that bill for Transportation for America to support it?
Well, first of all, it has to stop being the so-called highway bill. Nothing against the highway network that we have. We have one of the best in the world. That has been done. We've done it. There's a juggernaut of existing industries and bureaucrats who want to perpetuate it because that's what they know. But that can't be allowed to happen anymore. This can't just be about pork and about dividing up the spoils. So we have lots of suburban areas in this country, inner suburbs, older suburbs, that have lost their luster, that have lost a lot of the commercial that they had, these long strips of commercial that are fallow, underused. These are the places that we ought to be thinking about redeveloping as more walkable, nice new neighborhoods that can be served by public transportation and by cars. And part of what we need to do is the kind of investment that would convert these corridors, that would support the new transportation options and the converting of these great big wide arterial roads into more walkable and bikeable corridors. We want to see the metro areas that want to get these things done have the latitude, the communities have the latitude to do it. So that would be number two, a greater share and more flexibility for local projects for public transportation, for biking and walking, and then the authority on the local level to get these projects done. The other issues would be accountability for progress on some national goals. You know, we don't set national goals for transportation in this country, but we should. We have a stated goal by President-elect Obama to dramatically reduce our dependence on foreign oil, and I would argue that foreign or not, it's oil dependence generally that we're really talking about. We have a climate crisis that we've now acknowledged and that we've committed to try to address. We have a housing issue where we need to have more people have access to houses that they can afford that are connected to jobs and the activities that they need to do. These are all connected back to the success of the transportation system. We also need to make sure that populations, that low-income minority populations have access to jobs, and that employers can be guaranteed that their workers can get to work. So there are ways to measure these things, progress on these national goals, and we think that the states and localities ought to, as they're given some more flexibility in some areas, ought to be held more accountable for meeting these national goals. Those would be the top line things that we're interested in.
David, you're doing important work. It's been a pleasure to talk with you on Smart City. Thanks.
Thanks so much for having me.
David Goldberg is Communications Director for Transportation for America. To find out more about their campaign, we have a link on our site to his at smartcityradio.com. And now for the latest news from the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
It's been the stereotypical city of the West. Rapid post-war development and suburbanization has spread subdivisions and senior citizens throughout the desert for years. But now it seems that the booming desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona may be cooling off. A variety of indicators are leading many in Phoenix to believe that the city's unbridled growth could be slowing. A recent article from the Arizona Republic highlighted some of those indicators, including a smaller number of water hookups in the area, fewer calls for police service, and the plague of foreclosed homes that has consumed many parts of the valley. And though some say this could mean a lower population for Phoenix when the 2010 census is taken, others argue that these indicators are little more than symptoms of the economic recession. Meanwhile, in San Francisco, plans are moving ahead to install new parking technology in 7 parts of the city that will function as a dynamic parking demand management system. Dubbed SF Park, the federally funded experiment will eventually charge varying fees for parking in certain parts of the city, depending on demand and supply. It's an idea described by author Donald Shoup in his 2005 book, The High Cost of Free Parking. According to a recent summary on Streets Blog San Francisco, the city's experiment will include 6,000 curbside spaces and another 11,500 in garages. The pilot program will run for a year and a half, and the city is hopeful that it will reduce traffic and increase revenues. And in Seattle, officials are getting behind their own transportation solution. After years of debate, it appears that transportation officials and politicians have come to an agreement on a replacement for Seattle's earthquake-damaged inner-city freeway. They've settled on a $4 billion tunnel to replace the Alaskan Way Viaduct, a heavily used double-decker freeway that suffered structural damage in a 2001 earthquake. It has been the topic of debate in the intervening years as officials proposed a variety of replacement options, from a complete reconstruction to a street-level redistribution of the freeway's traffic. But this week, Washington State, King County, and the city of Seattle finally came to an agreement on the tunnel alternative. Now the idea will move to the state legislature for approval, but opposition remains strong among key House members. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of Planetizen.com. Coming up after the break, we'll find out how Toronto is reclaiming its shoreline to create fabulous public space with John Campbell, who heads Waterfront Toronto. You're listening to Smart City. And a special welcome to our podcast listeners. You've heard us talk about our social networking site, My City, and the community there has been booming. Hundreds of listeners, just like you, have joined the site and are talking and collaborating on all the issues that mean the most to people who love cities. Want to join? Send us an email to our producer, Scotty, at smartcityradio.com, and he'll get you signed up. I look forward to seeing you online. And now, back to the show. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Waterfront Toronto is fusing smart design ethics with an eye on the public good to recapture Toronto's shore for the public. But how do you unlock a waterfront so that the entire city can use it? John Campbell is the president and CEO of Waterfront Toronto. The scope of this project, Waterfront Toronto, is breathtaking. Just how big is it?
Well, it's about 2,000 acres, but what's important about it is right next to the central business district of Toronto, which, of course, is the economic capital of Canada. So it's a huge opportunity. It's one of the largest urban renewal projects probably in the Western world, and it's probably one of the largest revitalization efforts in the world. And I differentiate because revitalization is much more than just real estate development.
Describe what's being planned for Toronto's waterfront.
Well, we're looking at putting out roughly about 40,000 residential units, 10 million square feet of employment space, cultural uses, retail, entertainment, and of course, great parks and public spaces. I mean, we're firm believers that great cities are defined by their public realm, not necessarily by their office buildings.
And as you talk about the public realm, I know that's one of the values that you expect this project to express. Tell me about the other values that you feel are fundamental to the project.
I used the word revitalization before as opposed to redevelopment, and I really try to differentiate in people's minds the difference. And the difference really is about living up to a public policy agenda. It's about how do you stop urban sprawl? How do you promote transit? How do you provide housing for all citizens, not just the affluent? How do you unlock the waterfront so that all the public can enjoy it? Really those kinds of things that we're concerned about. Now we are using, I'll call it the real estate economic model to help drive the funds to do this, but the motive behind it is to build a quality of place and a quality of life that will attract the best and brightest people and make Toronto economically competitive in a global sense.
Explain what you mean by a real estate economic model.
Well, the initial funding for the project, I mean, there's a large degree of infrastructure required. It was estimated in 1999, year 2000, the initial costs were about $17 billion Canadian of total investment, of which $4.3 billion was infrastructure. The governments gave us $500 million from each level of government. And, of course, you have a city, provincial, and federal level. So $1.5 billion of seed capital, plus control of their land. And a lot of land down there is owned by the government. So the model is really invest in infrastructure, sell some of this land to make a profit, and reinvest that profit in additional infrastructure, so that with $1.5 billion of seed capital plus the land, you can hopefully fill up the $4.3 billion of infrastructure budget.
Now, values tend to get compromised based on power relationships and the market. What is it that you won't give on?
Well, there are certain things that we're focusing on, like sustainability and design excellence. I think if you're trying to build a beautiful city, and you define it in your terms as clean and attractive, we sort of call it quality of place. And a lot of that's tied up to design excellence. And so we've actually put in place a design review panel that opines on the designs as they come through and makes sure, in fact, that we're not compromising on those kinds of issues, that we're building a great city, not just a mediocre city. So things like design excellence, sustainability is clearly a strong element. I think where we'll see any compromises probably is time. We know that our corporation has a 25-year life. And within that time frame, we'll probably have two or three business cycles where the market may subside, in which case we'll focus more on infrastructure and less on bringing the private sector in to build the apartments and, you know, and retail and commercial aspects. So we have the ability not to need to compromise an awful lot. And we can as well control a lot of what we're doing by contract as opposed to by zoning. Because the bulk of the land is government-owned, we can say to developers who bid on the parcels of land, fine, you bid on this land, but here's the deal. You know, you have to hook up to our district energy system. You have to build to a LEED Gold standard. And so we recognize initially when the market isn't too mature, that might cost us a little bit. Quite honestly, that's fine because our mandate isn't to extract every nickel out of the land. Our objective is to build a great community.
You've raised several questions I want to explore with you. First of all, let's talk about the design review panel. Sometimes design review panels serve to, frankly, homogenize design. I know that's not your expectation, nor your plan. Tell me how you manage the design review process so that you really do get design excellence.
Their mandate really is just to ensure that the design is great. They're not there to opine on whether they want yellow brick or red brick. It's much more about, is this great design? So we have attracted to the panel as volunteers a dozen of the best and brightest talent in Canada. So we've got people from Montreal, from Vancouver, from Toronto, right across the gamut in areas of architecture, landscape architecture, planning, and so forth, and sustainability, to sit on the panel and opine. And we bring the designs in at certain set stages, and they basically comment on them to ensure that, in fact, it is great design.
You also mentioned the value of sustainability that's central to the project. Are you breaking any new ground in that area?
Well, we're trying to be global leaders. I mean, we're trying to ensure that when people ask the question in 10 years' time, how do you build a sustainable city, that they look to Toronto as the model. We've explored things like vacuum waste. We haven't been able to put that in place yet because we have difficulties in the ownership model. But we're looking at things, we are implementing a district energy system, which would provide thermal energy, hot and cold, to every building in the waterfront. Again, supplied from a central source, which allows us to, what I call, future-proof those neighborhoods, because you can change the technology of producing that hot water at the source without disrupting consumers. So we start off with gas-fired boilers. We move to cogeneration. We go to biomass, biodiesel, geothermal, and so forth. So it allows us to move with technology and still, not disrupt the consumers.
You also mentioned the public realm and the importance of the public realm and the investments that are required on the front end of this project in the public realm. How do you evaluate your public realm investments?
and we do it a couple of ways. One is that we look at those areas and try to sequence our public realm development with the development of the private sector. So, for example, in the West Donlands precinct, which is about 90 acres, we're ensuring that the public realm and public artwork is developed in proximity to the initial development. So we're looking at ensuring that the development in the public realm is done first and then adjacent to those lands that are available for the RFPs for the private developers. So we're trying to do it in lockstep with the development, but be ahead of the development, because we do feel that developers will take advantage of the public realm quality, and that will inspire them to build better quality themselves. The other area is in the central waterfront, and that's being done more to recapture the water's edge for the public, as opposed to trying to improve the quality of the private sector immediately adjacent to it. So it's much more of a community-wide endeavor to ensure that we can say to the world, we've got a great waterfront.
Going back to sustainability for a minute and where you might be breaking new ground, do you expect to spin off any new business opportunities for Toronto by creating a new local market for green technologies or green methods?
Well, certainly on the district energy, we're out to the marketplace now looking for operators for that system. So that clearly is a private sector opportunity. We're also looking at putting in what we call ultra broadband, which is very high-speed broadband, which is quite, it's open access, and we're in the marketplace as well looking for an operator for that business. So there's two businesses that will be spun off quite separately from the real estate opportunities for the private sector.
You also have a major commitment to making the waterfront and the neighborhoods that you are developing a great walking neighborhood. What are the essential elements to making walking the dominant form of transportation?
It's providing a design that's mixed use to ensure that, in fact, these cities are pedestrian, so we're not building enclaves of pure residential and then an enclave somewhere else of pure office. We're trying to provide a very mixed-use environment that not only makes it pedestrian-friendly, but also makes it a fun place to be. I always define it as the waterfront being a place where you and I would want to go have a beer after work. It's that kind of place we want to create. And you don't do that by building entirely residential or entirely office or entirely retail. It's getting that mix that's so important. And it's, I think that's more of an art than a science, but it's trying to create that environment. So building in the pedestrian environment is a very important attribute.
One of the problems that a lot of cities run into with the concept of mixed use, everybody loves the idea, but so frequently, for whatever reason, the market is not robust enough to create that first floor use. They'll say, well, there's a market for housing in this neighborhood, but there's not yet a market for retail or restaurants or something that, as you said, makes the neighborhood fun to go to, makes the neighborhood fun to walk around in. Did you face those problems? Or do you think you'll face those problems in Waterfront Toronto? And if so, how are you going to deal with them?
Oh, very, very much so. It's the ground floor animation has been a real challenge. In fact, at one time when we were looking at going out, I'll call it on a building-by-building basis for the waterfront, we were looking at taking back the ground floor on a strata title basis and basically us taking it back and trying to manage it like you would a shopping center to make sure you have the right tenants in the right locations. We've now gone out with a much larger RFP, and we're relying on the developer to do that for us under one ownership. But we also do know that single-sided retail is difficult, and retail without vehicles is going to be challenging. What we'll end up doing in a lot of cases is putting in a lot of cultural and other uses that can actually pay rent and be down there, but there'll be a lot of community cultural uses that will support the retail.
This project, Waterfront Toronto, has been a part of Toronto's imagination for years and years. How did you finally get it underway?
There's been probably almost a century of studies about the waterfront. There's decades and decades of studies. And we did face a huge public cynicism when we first started that, oh, yes, okay, more studies, more public money spent with consultants to study it to death. And the change this time came about as part of Toronto's Olympic bid for 2008, which was unsuccessful. But nonetheless, it was the catalyst, the bid was the catalyst, for the three governments to come together and say, how are we going to operationalize this and make it really happen? And even after the bid went to Beijing, the government sort of said, well, look, I think this is still worth doing. And looking at models around the world, what seemed to work was creating an agency that was apart from government, was funded and empowered and given a mandate to do it. And so the governments basically took that on board and said, okay, let's do that and let's create a separate agency, fund it, empower it, and, you know, move it forward. And so in 2001, we were created on an interim basis and then officially kind of created in 2003. But it was sort of the result of that initial Olympic bid thinking back in the late 90s.
It's interesting how special events. I was in South Africa recently and saw the same sort of response to the World Cup, where these big global events certainly have a catalytic effect on cities. And it's amazing how quickly you can get very big things done when you know the world is going to be watching. You said that Toronto looked around the world for inspiration and found an organizational model. I'm curious where you took inspiration from a design sense on waterfronts around the world.
Oh, on the design sense, we looked at about 32 different cities because what seemed to be critical was this perception by the public of the water's edge. And do you have, and I'll draw some examples, some extremes here. Chicago has, what, a quarter mile green swath around the loop. Amsterdam has probably, 15 feet between the buildings and the canals. So there's, you know, some really broad extremes there. And we went through great, great public debate as to what the right dimensions were, because you wanted something that was, in our case, it was an urban edge we were building. We have lots of parkland. We've got, and even in our proposal, we've got something like 90-some-odd parks and parkettes, about 500 acres. But we're building an urban edge because we're trying to intensify the waterfront and find a location for the province to grow cities and grow density. But it was a very debated issue as to what is the right dimension. We looked at Vancouver, Chicago, Melbourne, Sydney, London, Hamburg, Barcelona. And I think we came down to this kind of 19 meters as being the appropriate dimension to provide for a great pedestrian realm. And in our case, there was a desire not to have cars on the water's edge. So that was the pedestrian realm. And on top of that, we had another sort of 8 meters going out over the water with a boardwalk. And that was kind of the consensus after looking at all these cities around the world and looking at this sort of key dimension, which was debated for probably a year.
That's fascinating. There are ongoing, every summer, there is a new debate about how to separate bikers from pedestrians on the Chicago waterfront because the uses are so intense. So many people trying to grab a part of that real estate for themselves, and between the skaters and the bikers and the walkers, you can have some serious accidents. And, you know, it's always a summertime debate. You staged your annual meeting recently at which you conducted the most civilized, the most productive public meeting I've ever witnessed. I want to know how you do that, because, and I know others will want to know how you do that. It was really quite extraordinary with your constituents asking you respectful but sometimes very tough questions, but also almost in the same breath thanking you for being their advocate.
Well, we've taken our role as a public steward very, very seriously, and I would say we've earned the public's trust so far, and that's probably the strongest asset that the corporation currently has. We've been very fortunate. We've got a very good community, well-organized, that we deal with, and we've answered their questions very straightforwardly. And we committed early on that we would have a very heavy consultation process. And what we've done is we've linked the environmental assessments we have to do, which are part of the regulatory environment, with our planning issues. And we've honestly listened to people, and we've changed plans relative to what the neighbors have told us. So I think what you saw at our annual general meeting was the result of 5 years of good work with the public. We have probably, over the last 2 years, averaged 60 public meetings a year. And those public meetings, I mean, we don't have one every week on the same things. We have a variety of projects underway. And what we do is we typically have public meetings, which are, just by their very nature, public, where anyone can come. And in between those public meetings, we might have four or so in a project's life. But in between, we have what we call stakeholder meetings, and we'll go out to the key opinion leaders in those communities, people who have an elected or quasi-elected kind of role. For example, in a community, we'll say, okay, we have a public meeting, but now let's have, for stakeholders, let's have the executive team from the local BIA and the local community association and this condo association. So we'll ask for those people to come and participate in a meeting of 15 to 20 people, and have a roll-your-sleeves-up kind of meeting, and we'll have the designers there and our project managers there and deal with the issues. And so in between each of the public meetings, we have stakeholder meetings, and we sort of alternate sort of a public meeting, stakeholder meeting, public meeting. I think it's given people a sense of the fact that we're prepared to work with them. We just don't go through the motions of listing and saying, like, thank you very much, and go on as before. We really do have an open mind on this, and we listen. And even our public meetings most often are organized in a way that's designed to solicit input. So typically the public meetings are roundtable workshops where we actually get good input to the current phase of design that we're at.
I want to squeeze in two more quick questions. For cities attempting to reclaim their waterfronts, what advice would you give them?
One of the I think, the most important issues is to ensure that whoever's doing it has a strong mandate. I mean, we still have issues we need to sort of shore up in some of our governance models and so forth. So I think you need to have an organization that has a really clear mandate. And the second is, I think, is to ensure that there's a very heavy public consultation and public engagement. I think those are, I think, some of the keys to success.
Did the public share your ambition around this project? I mean, I have a hard time imagining that the public said, we want you really to model the next generation city here with sustainability and walkability and design excellence. I mean, is that what the public told you, or was it a question of you leading the public? I'm just curious.
Well, I think the corporation's charged with the responsibility of coming up with that vision, but it isn't without sort of public consultation. So, in fact, we were the ones initially that said, look, if we're going to do this, we have to revitalize, not just redevelop. I mean, Carol, you don't need an agency like ours to just peddle real estate in the waterfront. Just basically put up a sign and it'll sell. For us, it was how do we drive the right public policy agenda? And then as we're doing the public consultation. So you're quite right. The public didn't come up and said, we want you to design a sustainable city and we want you to design a city that has these features. There is that trade-off between us being responsible for a vision, but executing it with the public's help and support and buy-in.
John, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
It's been my pleasure.
John Campbell is the president and CEO of Waterfront Toronto. For a link to pictures of the waterfront and all of his new projects, go to our website, smartcityradio.com. There is troubled water ahead for our City Views commentator. This week, Walker Smith shares a recent adventure of a low moment on the high seas.
Last year, our annual Christmas paddle in Charleston Harbor turned into an adventure. The Christmas Boat Parade is a holiday tradition held each year the first Saturday night in December. People rig motorboats with all kinds of holiday decorations and then slowly cruise in single file through the harbor while a fireworks show lights up overhead. Our 20 or so kayaks are a sideshow to the main event, but we have fun dressing up in Santa suits and outfitting our kayaks with lights and greenery and snowmen and Christmas trees and all kinds of other elaborate flashing contraptions that people invent just for the occasion. We paddle close to the historic Charleston Battery and yell Merry Christmas and Happy New Year and Ho, Ho, Ho. Last year, though, our paddle got off to a confused start. We put in at a different boat landing than in years past that was a mile further upriver. That created trouble coordinating with the motorboats making their turn to start the parade. Plus, we had some over-decorated kayaks being paddled by less experienced people who were struggling to keep up. The plan was to paddle down to the point of the battery on the Cooper River side and then go back. But we got carried away in the moment and went the entire length of the battery down the Cooper River side and up the Ashley River side. We turned to head back nearly an hour behind schedule. When we finally cut across the harbor to head to the boat landing, the harbor had been reopened to commercial boat traffic, which means tugboats and massive container ships, and they operate well into the night. Halfway across, we were stopped by a harbor patrol boat that was stunned we were out there. They made us stay in place, paddling hard to hold steady against the current and tide, while three tugboats and a container ship passed in front of us no more than 75 yards away. The container ship towered so high above us that I couldn't even raise my head up high enough to see the top. Then the Coast Guard told us to paddle as fast as we could to get across before the next boats were due. We made a mad, adrenaline-fueled dash, followed by a mile and a half upriver slog to the boat ramp. When we finally finished our six-hour adventure, half of our group was totally spent and had to be helped out of their boats. Luckily, we were all okay, although we felt a bit like the people stranded on Gilligan's Island who had only intended to take a three-hour tour. That night was a reminder that everything we do, no matter what it is, can have a bad ending if poorly planned. In retrospect, a year later, it even seems like an omen of the year to come. For in the ensuing 12 months, we have seen just how far our economic prosperity can sink when we approach it with the same kind of poor planning and careless regard. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of the Yankelovich Monitor, a trend service of the Futures Company. He joins us each week from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta, and his latest book is Generation Ageless. There is a lot more from Smart City on our website, smartcityradio.com. You can subscribe to our podcast, sign up for our weekly newsletter, or drop us a line. Let us know how we're doing. Click on the contact button or send us an email, questions@smartcityradio.com. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, and national distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Additional support provided by National Trust Main Street Center, revitalizing America's traditional business districts to build sustainable communities. Visit www.mainstreet.org. Scotty Iseri is our producer and engineer. His New Year's resolution is making him cranky. I'm Carol Coletta.